Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. The New York Times says if you want to go to graduate school to change the world, then you should go to the Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco or Seattle. In case you haven't heard of it yet, Presidio Graduate School is helping to reinvent graduate education. It was started by a lawyer and a former advertising executive who saw a need for a school that produced the kind of socially minded graduates the country needs. Although it was founded only 16 years ago, Presidio already ranks at the top of the list for graduate programs for both social impact and environmental sustainability. To learn more about this gem and their innovative programming, we have with us today two guests who are on the faculty of Presidio Graduate School. Our first guest is Khalid Kadir, an international expert on clean water who has brought a social justice lens to engineering. He will be followed by faculty member Paul Herman, professor and program director of sustainable finance, who shows us how we can solve human, social, and environmental problems through financial investments. First up is Khalid Kadir, an international expert on clean water who has brought a social justice lens to engineering. He earned a PhD in civil and environmental engineering from the University of California, Berkeley. He was selected to create and teach an innovative interdisciplinary engineering course that combines community-engaged scholarship with classroom learning to train engineers to engage with the social and political roots of their technical work. Khalid Kadir, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you combine some very interesting things, but I want to get into your coursework in a minute, but let's start with how clean is the water we drink in the United States right now?
Well, that kind of depends on where you live in the United States. We have a lot of many different water systems throughout the country, and I live in the East Bay in California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. We have very clean water. It comes from a reservoir in the Sierras, and much of the way down to the East Bay, it is underground. Other areas in California have water that travels from the Sierras above ground, and then, you know, a lot of things get into the water, so it's a little less clean. In the East Bay, we have very clean water. But a lot of folks in California and throughout the country have water that they can't drink. There are a number of communities in the Central Valley and in the Salinas Valley that have nitrate and arsenic poisoning in their water, and they can only drink or wash with bottled water that's brought to their home. So it's sort of one of those questions. It depends.
Yeah, right. Well, we know the major problems in Flint, Michigan, but I'm afraid that's not just an isolated problem. So it's a little more widespread.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, one of the interesting things about that is that we're running up kind of on the edges of science with some of this too, that we know if you have a certain amount of arsenic in your water that it's going to be unhealthy. We know if you have a certain amount of lead in your water that it's going to be unhealthy. But with all the contaminants that are out there, the combined effects, all the different sort of permutations of concentration of X and concentration of Y together, what's the effect of that? There's a lot of uncertainty. On top of that, there are a lot of emerging contaminants related to pesticides and other chemicals that are making their way into our water system that are creating quite a bit of uncertainty.
Yeah, so what do you recommend our listeners do? Should we be putting filters on our taps? Should we test our water to see how bad it is? Or what do you think we should be doing?
I think, again, it depends on where you live. I think in the East Bay, I drink the tap water, and I don't think twice about it. Most places that I travel in the United States, it's the same way. I drink the water, and I don't worry about it. I think the most important thing that listeners can do is get involved in their local governance and get informed and get involved and be a part of the decision-making processes. you know, anything that we do collectively, it always involves some degree of risk, and being able to sort of be involved and informed and make informed decisions about the kinds of risks communities are willing to take in their decision making, I think is really important.
That's great. And then the other issue that some people are worried about, I know corporate accountability has been tracking this, but the effort by international corporations to kind of get a hold of our water supplies worldwide. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of contention over this. I mean, the famous, perhaps the most famous case is that of Bolivia, when Bechtel, a corporation based out of here in San Francisco, gained private ownership of the water in Bolivia, and eventually it was not profitable to deliver water to some of the poor sort of members of the community, and so they cut people off, and you can't go for very long without water, and so that, of course, resulted in a backlash. But this is a phenomenon that's happened in different ways at different places, and there's a lot of debate about what is the values or the risks of these sort of public-private arrangements, what are the ethical implications of treating water, which is on one hand, a basic human right, treating it as a economic good that can be bought and sold for profit. And there are the famous Dublin principles around water. Both of those show up in there, one that it's a human right, the other that it's an economic good. And there's a lot of question about what are the right ways to do this, what are the concerns we have with large institutions gaining ownership over water, and what are the risks for the more marginalized members of society. I think this is sort of an ongoing challenge that hasn't really been resolved, but it's definitely something, and it brings me back to that point about the need for citizens to be involved in the governance of the places where they live, and so they can be informed and make the kinds of decisions that they feel are best for their communities. And part of that is going to be, what does it mean to have a private institution owning the water that you drink, and if their structural sort of political economic orientation is towards profit and yours is towards clean water, can you find a way to meet those two, or might you sort of look for alternative arrangements?
Well, and the communities would want not only clean water but affordable water, because, as you say, you know, water is life. We can't live without it. So we don't want companies to be privatizing something that's a broader social need and a common good, really. They didn't create the water. It's in nature.
Exactly. And what does it mean to get a hold of sort of collective resources and put them in the hands of a small number of folks to earn profit from? I think this is a major ethical challenge. As we, you know, I like to think we're sort of on the tail end of this sort of market fundamentalism, where we try to put everything for sale on markets, and this fictional idea that that's going to be the most efficient way to allocate resources. And as we come out of that sort of haze, I think we need to once again think critically about what sort of values we want to promote, and what does it mean to share ownership collectively over things? What does it mean to govern them democratically instead of in the hands of sort of a private entity with different priorities? I think these are questions that are coming up around water. They're questions that are coming up around fossil fuels. It's coming up around a lot of our natural resources. Here in California, we run into that, you know, with this ongoing challenge over urban versus agricultural water use. Most of our water use in California is in the agricultural sector. A chunk of it is left for fish, so it continues out into the ocean, and then you have ag as the dominant user, and then urban use. So all the focus on decreasing water consumption in urban areas is incredibly important, if nothing else from an ethical perspective. Let's not waste water when it's a limited resource. But I think the bigger question is, what does it mean for very large private agricultural operations to be using the bulk of our water to make profits and not to sort of serve the common good? I think that's a real challenge that we need to wrestle with more explicitly here.
That's great, and I think that's a perfect example of the kind of work that I understand you do, which is bringing a social justice lens to engineering. So instead of just being trained in the technical version of, well, how do I build this waterway, that you're actually bringing in an understanding about values, an understanding of the community, and issues like that around engineering. Is that right?
Trying to. I don't want to posit that I'm actually doing it, but I'm certainly trying. And I think that, and it's not just engineering. Engineering was kind of my gateway to this because I was trained as an engineer. But I also grew up sort of very concerned about people and where people end up in these engineered systems. And I found that throughout my own education, it was hard to put these two together. In my engineering coursework, there wasn't a lot of space to think about people outside of very narrow constructs, that the person is a water user and that's it, or a person is a energy user and that's it, and not thinking about people as having sort of diverse life experiences, society having inequality and marginalization and all of this. And it wasn't until I started sort of delving into the social sciences and learning about sort of social science theory around how experts engage with problems and the ways in which, you know, we narrow down problems. And we do that because it makes it easier to solve them. You know, if we look at an entire system and try to solve the whole system at once, we end up paralyzed. Mm-hmm. But I think experts have a very reductive way of doing it that doesn't always make space for individual people's agency and involvement in the process. And inevitably, those who are most marginalized, rendered invisible, those are the ones who don't have a say in a lot of these sort of plans and projects. And so I saw this through the lens of engineering experts. You know, they draw these boxes around problems and solve what's in the box and ignore everything else. And some of the things that they ignore are the sort of forms of marginalization. They ignore questions about who has power and who doesn't, and how does that shape what we think good and bad outcomes are, and what might it look like to say, hey, wait, what if we considered folks who are marginalized and how they might see this problem, and what priorities might they have in this? I then, you know, through my own sort of work, I then went on to think about how different experts in other disciplines do the same thing. So I teach a lot of sort of political economy, and that's one of the things I'm doing at Presidio, is teaching what is in some ways a political economy class, trying to help future business professionals and public administrators understand the dangers of looking at something through a very narrow, expert-driven framework, and help them think in a more systems perspective, which is really what Presidio is trying to do across the board, and to think about where are people in your system, and who's rendered invisible when you draw your systems, and who's affected by this but doesn't necessarily have a seat at the table, and how might that change the conversations we have at that table if we start including people who are historically not sitting there. So,
Great. And can you give an example in your own work about how engineers could bring a social justice lens to their technical work?
Yeah, I think, you know, let's run with the example of water. If we're talking about water quality in a municipality, and an engineer is hired to design a water treatment plant, and I'm just sort of running through sort of fictitious example, but I think it'll serve the purpose. You know, an engineer who's hired to design a water treatment system is going to think about inputs and outputs. They're going to think about what chemicals do I need, what mechanical processes do I need in order to achieve certain water quality criteria established by the EPA, established by the state, and they're going to look at what's coming in and what's going out and try to make that work. I think another way that we can do this that doesn't simply turn this into a narrow technical conversation is to invite stakeholders representative of the communities that we're working in to sit at the table and say, hey, this is what we're trying to do. Let me sort of demystify the work I do and explain the sort of options I see at the table, explain how the state and EPA sort of regulates water quality, and also explain that this is sort of for a generalized, normal, healthy person, but folks who suffer from health issues, folks who are subjected to multiple stressors like air pollution or other kinds of stressors in their life, these water quality regulations weren't designed for them. They were designed for someone who's not undergoing all these other kinds of stress. So we can think about, you know, being better than the regulations, but that also costs money, and we can collectively make this decision about how do we want to move forward and what kind of system do we want to design. So at some level, what I'm getting at is to try to democratize expertise and allow people to empower people with the knowledge of what engineers are doing, and empower them with the ability to comment and get involved in the design construction of these systems. And this is just on the design side, but when we think about building out water systems and governing those water systems later, we can think about, like, who should be in charge of our local water system? And invite mm-hmm. communities to be the stakeholders who make those decisions. And I think overwhelmingly, when communities are invited to that kind of conversation, they're like, no, we want to be in charge of our water system. We don't want someone else who doesn't live here, who's not accountable for if something goes wrong with it, not directly accountable because they're not drinking the water. We don't want them in charge. And so and if we're going to build this system, we want our own community members to get the jobs to do the building of this system. So there's so many ways along this trajectory of building a system, from the design to the construction to the management to the governance of it, in which if community members are in the driver's seat with an eye towards sort of being representative of the different voices in the community that don't always get represented, I think engineers can one, engage in a much more social process in their engineering, and two, have much more robust designs, and take some of the pressure off of themselves of having to get it right, and say, this is a collective process. There is no perfect water treatment plant. There are trade-offs all along the way, and let's make those trade-offs in sort of a democratic collective process.
Well, that sounds really good. And you mentioned about teaching the students to get beyond the box and not be in a narrow area, but, you know, think more broadly and actually think systemically about whatever project they're engaging in. How do you enable your first-year students at Presidio to do systems thinking for social justice?
Yeah, it's sometimes challenging, and I think one of the challenges is often students come in the door with a solution in their hand. They feel as though they already know what the answer is. Like, you know, food waste is a problem. They're like, oh, we got this. We've got a plan for composting it or redistributing it out to, you know, shelters or something like that. And I try to really push students back and say, hey, wait, how did you even define the problem in the first place? What is this problem that you're trying to solve? And not only what is the problem, who is it a problem for? Like, and then once you say, who is it a problem for, ask the question, have they been, you know, invited to talk about what this problem looks like to them and how they may see it solved? And I think really sort of pushing upstream in that way to get it, like, hey, let's not presume we understand the problem because we're sitting in socially privileged mm-hmm. positions. I'm teaching students in graduate school. They're relatively privileged in the big picture. And so thinking about, hey, might we think about redefining the problem based on how those who are frontline communities understand the problem? Might we sort of get outside of our own offices and our own classrooms and get into community spaces and talk to community members who might see the problems very, very differently than the way we do, and they might understand them differently? And so part of what I do in the class is actually get students out into the world and say, hey, you need to go. I have them focus on a single issue in this first semester course, and I said, you need to go get different perspectives on this issue. You need to engage with folks who are materially, culturally, spiritually, physically, directly affected by the issue you're interested in. So you need to talk to frontline communities who, anything you do, it's going to affect them immediately, and you need to see how they think of this and what their thoughts are on the problem, really with a focus on, let's just make sure we understand the problem we're solving so that we're not solving the wrong problem.
Right, or creating a new one.
Absolutely, absolutely. Which is like a really common thing, right? Like, we go to solve problems. You know, we tried to solve the problem of not enough food, and now we have the problem of pesticides in our waterways. or nitrates and phosphorus choking up our waterways. And so there's this that approach to problem solving that is not looking at a systems level view is one that doesn't take us very far, and it may solve the problem for a small group of people, generally those who are most powerful or most wealthy, but then it creates problems that affect other people disproportionately, and we see this divergence where we see more inequality. People who are suffering more, and people who are doing well are able to sort of buy their way out of that problem.
Right. And what are some of the projects that some of the students you've taught have gone on to do? Do they keep in touch? Are you aware of what they choose to do in their careers?
Yeah, I'm relatively new at Presidio, so it's mm-hmm. maybe hasn't been long enough to see people through sort of long-term careers, but I have seen students sort of start running with some of the projects that they've done in our courses. We also have an experiential learning program that's pretty exciting because it connects students with outside partners, and some students have tried to go on and work with those partners around really thinking about alternative ways to address problems in the world. One interesting project I worked with a couple of students not so long ago at Presidio, they were trying to tackle the challenge of businesses transitioning to new ownership. And apparently there's a high percentage of businesses owned in the United States by folks who are wanting to retire. And these are relatively small, medium-sized businesses, nothing huge. And they were trying to help them think about ways of transitioning to a co-op model so that the employees could then own the business themselves rather than a single owner. And they're thinking about creative ways to facilitate that process, to help employees sort of gain a stake in the place where they work, and really trying to transition asset ownership in America in this way and change the model of employer-employee into this cooperative co-owner model, which I think those kinds of efforts are really exciting. Another set of things that some students are working on is they're trying to figure out how to get involved in the space of community land trusts, and to try to get out of the sort of dominant finance mechanisms that are fundamentally extractive. You know, I think personally, as long as we're dealing with, you know, we're loaning out people money and they're paying it back plus some, we've locked ourselves into a model of economics that requires economic growth. You know, if I loan you $10 and you have to pay me $12, and on top of that you have to make your own salary, now you need to make $14 off of that $10. And so we're locking ourselves into continued material extraction, and inevitably those who are doing the financing are making money on those who need the financing. So we're in this situation where renters, people with wealth, are accumulating wealth faster than those who are working to earn their living. And this is a perspective Thomas Piketty wrote about in his now pretty famous book, Capital in the 21st Century, that we see this forces of divergence. And I'm excited about students trying to undo that, trying to think about how do we do maybe interest-free perspectives on financing, and how do we get real estate outside of speculative frameworks to where real estate is about people buying the home to live in. It's not about making an investment in some future financial return. It's about the human right to housing. It's not about the private right to profit. And I'm excited about students really trying to think outside of the box. And one of the exciting things about Presidio is that to do that, you have to engage in an intersectoral conversation. You can't do that without engaging with governance structures, without engaging with laws and policies. You know, the IRS struggles with how do you deal with money that is made that is not made through interest-based frameworks. IRS has, like, complicated rules around, you know, the sort of rent-to-own models that are out there. It's really complicated to declare your taxes in that situation. So students are really trying to think about what are all the pieces I have to bring together to make this a viable thing so that folks who are left out of asset ownership might have a way to get in that, but not through the conventional means of making those who have a lot of wealth gain wealth even faster. So I'm inspired by those students who are trying to do that.
Yeah, that's great. And you've done just amazing work in very innovative work in bringing a social justice lens to the engineering. for our listeners who may not be engineers, do you have any suggestions on how people could add the social justice lens to whatever they do?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think the first thing that comes to mind is those who are doing any sort of technical work to really try to think about getting outside of that technical box. You know, you are not just a doctor. You are not just an engineer. You are not just a technician of some sort. You are also a person, and that brings so much more to the conversation. And to really think about how do we recognize the ways in which our technical work reinforces or undermines current structures of power, marginalization, inequality. More broadly, I think really opening up the space for community conversations, opening up the space to disagree, opening up the space to work through different values and different beliefs. I think we need to sit down and have more of those conversations. You know, people talk a lot about the polarization in the United States today and whatnot, and I think we're often looking for fixes that don't require us to talk about our disagreements. And I think we need to actually create spaces where we can do more of that, where we can sit down together, we live in community, and we can work through the differences we have. And in that process, I think we have to be really attuned to who is invited to those conversations, who is able to show up at them, and think how can we make it so that those who are historically and continue to be left out of those conversations, the people working two jobs, the people who don't have documentation, and how can we make sure that their voice is at the table and that we're taking a historical lens into addressing this issue. We're not simply looking at today, but we're looking at how did this come to look this way through history, and what would it mean to take a justice-based perspective that accounts for the historical processes that got us here today? Because historical processes got us to a place where some people are doing better than others, and many, not all, but many of those historical processes were on the back of injustice. And so what would it mean to repair those injustices? What would it mean, and how might we take a very sort of ethical approach to saying, hey, we want to do right in the world, and we don't want to live off the back of other injustices. Let's start thinking about how to make up for that. I think that's a really important approach.
Great. Well, I really admire your commitment to clean water and your commitment to inclusion and really having the technical skills and abilities being tied to community values and visions and desires of what they want to have in the areas that they live. I'm wondering if you were advising the next president of the United States about what to do regarding clean water, and you had a magic wand to get whatever you wanted. What do you think we need to do right now in the United States to get more clean water for everybody?
Stop making it dirty.
Okay.
I think that's the first thing I would say. Like, we wouldn't have a problem of trying to find clean water if we didn't make it dirty in the first place. So,
Most pollution coming from?
Where is what?
Agriculture? Most of the pollution for the water?
I think it's coming primarily from industrial processes, whether those are agricultural or chemical or mining industry, you know, depending on where you are. West Virginia, mountaintop coal removal, destroying the waterways, making it unhealthy to drink. Central Valley of California, overloading with nitrate fertilizers, making its way down into the groundwater. You know, there's an agricultural industry. This Dow Chemicals gotten in a lot of trouble, or Dow or DuPont actually gotten a lot of trouble recently for chemicals that were in the waterways as a result of their industrial processes. I think industrial processes in general have been the culprit of this, and I think we really need to put a stop to that.
Right. Well said. Well, is there any final comment you'd like to make before we wrap up?
No, I'm super optimistic about the energy that I see in my students, and I'm hopeful that we can slow down a little and have these kinds of conversations and really start thinking about how might we live our lives through a more justice-based, ethically sound framework. So I'm excited about those possibilities.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have. Khalid Kadir, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Thank you so much.
Our next guest is Paul Herman, who says we can solve human, social, and environmental problems through finance. He is professor and program director of sustainable finance at Presidio Graduate School. He's also the CEO of HIP Investor Ratings and Portfolios. He's the author of a book called The HIP Investor, Make Bigger Profits by Building a Better World, which is now included in the curricula of 27 global MBA and university programs in finance and impact investing. He's going to tell us how we can do good and make money at the same time. Paul Herman, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's start for beginners in this field. Can you please explain what is sustainable finance?
Sure. Sustainable finance would make sense to all of us, including our moms, if we thought about it this way. If we hire the best people and treat them well and create an environment where people can do their best work, as well as Kala just introduced, treating the environment in a regenerative way, in a cradle-to-cradle way, and that if our business processes and industrial processes and agricultural processes follow those principles of people first and planet at the same time, then those businesses, those resulting finances, are actually stronger and more resilient. And what we found is companies who put people first, who are the best companies to work for, and who are environmentally sustainable, tend to have higher financial returns and lower future risk.
Very interesting. So you claim that we can solve our human, social, and environmental problems through this sustainable finance, sustainable investing. How do you think we solve the world's problems with investing?
Well, there's many problems in the world, and they've actually been synthesized in the what's called the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. So there's 17 different goals ranging from no poverty to gender equality to clean water. And so those 17 goals, you can actually build portfolios and investment themes around, and you can invest in stocks and bonds or in mutual funds and exchange-traded funds, or even through your 401k. And so what that allows you to do then is to choose a problem to solve, like clean water, like we talked about just previous with Professor Collett at Presidio, and to invest in companies that deliver water efficiency, water equipment, as well as invest in water utilities who deliver clean water to the citizens. And so through a combination of muni bonds, stocks, and even funds, like the First Trust Water Fund, you can focus on solving a problem in the world and making money at the same time.
That's really interesting. Now, when you say the sustainable finance, is that the same thing as impact investing?
They're all under the same umbrella, at least mm-hmm. the way that we look at it. So there's every investment that we make, so every dollar that we spend when we're purchasing something or every investment dollar in our portfolio or 401k, every time we do that, that has a positive impact or a negative impact on the world. And so it's actually possible to analyze the impacts of when you spend that dollar, or real in Brazil or rand in South Africa, to say, how is this impacting the world? Mm-hmm. And so when you buy something like an electric car from Tesla, you're actually saving all the fossil fuels that that car would burn in the future. So there's a net positive contribution to the environment. There's some short-term costs to the environment for how you make the battery and the rare earths that go into that battery and some of the metals or aluminum that construct it. But on the life cycle of that car, that is a net positive for society. And so as you look at your portfolio and you think about the products and services that each of those companies in your portfolio make, the more you support companies that make good products like electric vehicles and you avoid companies that make bad products like fossil fuels that are going to add more carbon to the environment, you're making a positive impact on the world. And over time, what we've seen through more than 2,000 academic studies around the world is sustainable investing or impact investing or what's being called ESG, environmental social governance investing. Those portfolios, when you tilt towards solving problems in the real world and minimizing negative effects, generally have the same or higher returns at the same or lower risk.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, some of the things that, like the fossil fuel-oriented investments are, you know, they're kind of being outpaced now. The growth is really in the wind power and solar power and other areas. So it makes a lot of sense that you could make more money with less risk. And, you know, this is, it's such an exciting idea to me that people can support what they care about through their investments and make money from doing it. So if you care about, as you mentioned, the range of issues that we have out there, you want to address climate change, you want to encourage less poverty, you want more inclusive economies, kind of whatever it is that you care about, you could find ways to invest there. But how would you do that? Say if one of our listeners is interested in this, they say, yeah, you know, I'm really worried about climate change. The government's working too slowly. I'd like to use my money and make sure that it's oriented towards addressing climate change. What would our listener do? Who would they talk to?
Sure. Yeah, there's several resources out there today. So the Trade Association for Sustainable Investing is the Sustainable Investing Foundation, or USSIF. So if you go to USSIF.org, you'll see a mix of firms, companies, investment products that you can investigate and explore. There's a website called Social Funds. So if you go to Social Funds, you'll see a list of about 200 different investment funds, publicly listed mutual funds. And you can see the range of focusing on things like Great Place to Work that you might get from a company like Parnassus. Parnassus used to be called, have a fund called the Parnassus Workplace Fund. It's now called the Parnassus Endeavor Fund. That's been a strong performer over most of its life. There's another fund called Portfolio 21. That's run by a company called Trillium. And so these are investment strategies that either focus on people, focus on the environment, or both, where the strength and resilience of the companies is actually better for your portfolio and better for people and planet at the same time. And so, for example, Portfolio 21, over almost a 20-year time period, has beaten the S&P 500 with reasonable risk, whereas there actually is something called the Vice Fund. There's a mutual fund that invests in gambling and guns and casinos. And while that, too, has beaten the S&P 500, it's done it at twice the risk. So some other ideas, there's a fund called ESO Capital. That's a diversified fund across industries, but that is climate-friendly. And so it minimizes the negative climate impacts and allocates to companies that are focusing on solving, taking climate action. And then there's even companies today that have signed up for science-based targets. And so you may see soon some portfolios that incorporate science-based targets, which means we don't have to, like, we have to go beyond trying to reduce carbon emissions 10% per year. We actually need to reduce them 80, 90, 100%, or even be net positive. So that's a variety of resources of websites and financial products to explore.
Yeah, that's great. You mentioned there's actually a thing called the Vice Fund. I've never heard of that. They actually call it that?
They actually call it that. The ticker is VICEX. So it's very interesting if you want to bet on the weakness of humans to gamble or shoot or the like. But there's also new websites like Open Invest, that allow you to customize your own index. And so at openinvest.com, you can invest in, you can pick what's important to you, and it'll auto-customize a portfolio. And so we've listed some great place to work strategies from Hip Investor, as well as a diversified fossil-free portfolio on Open Invest as well.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, we got Warren Buffett here, one of the richest men in the world and a brilliant investor, is advising the average people to put their money into an index fund, like the Vanguard Index Fund or something. But if you have this kind of social awareness and you want to direct your fund, you're talking about customizing your own index fund, can you do that through Vanguard, or you need to go through a separate group like Open Invest?
Yeah, groups like Open Invest and others are starting to emerge. You can essentially customize your what they do is they enable, they use their power of computer engineering and financial savvy to take what your preferences are to say, I want gender diverse boards. Or for some people, you might say, I don't want any companies affiliated with Trump. And then to take those preferences and to reconstruct a portfolio based on companies who fit those preferences. So this is the next way. First, you know, first we could buy stocks, then we could buy mutual funds, which only traded at the end of the day. Then we could buy exchange-traded funds that could trade during the day. Many of those strategies are index strategies, which means you buy some version of the whole market. What it's turning to today is custom indexing, like custom to yourself. So through the benefit of computing and setting your preferences, that can make it really powerful. Also, what is possible is to apply a sustainability rating on that company as to how well or badly you're treating employees. So the best companies to work for, which is the list that the Parnassus Workplace Fund, Endeavor Fund, draws from, it's been shown that over the past going on 20 years, Alex Edmonds from the Wharton School, my alma mater, where I got my original finance degree before teaching at Presidio as a professor with a sustainable finance concentration, he found that investing in the public companies who are the best companies to work for generally outperforms the market, sometimes by up to 2 times. And so this is going beyond index investing that Warren Buffett and Jack Bogle of Vanguard, who recently passed away, have espoused. And so you're seeing this with a generational shift, too, Eleanor, because Warren Buffett's grandson, Howie Buffett, just wrote a new book called Social Value Investing. So Warren Buffett was a fan of value investing, and his grandson has written a book called Social Value Investing with a Columbia professor. And so they're looking at the rate of return on impact on the world, or the impact rate of return. So a new form of a financial term called IRR used to stand for internal rate of return, and they've developed something called impact rate of return. So lots of exciting things happening in investing and in finance that everyday investors can pursue.
Oh, I'm excited to hear that. I want to read Howie Buffett's book. I actually met him when he was on the transition team when Obama was becoming president. He's a really bright, creative, value-oriented guy. So it's nice to see the next generation coming up here. Now, you founded the HIP Investor, and you rate over 120,000 stocks, bonds, and funds for investors and their advisors. I'm wondering, when you look at that, like, can you tell how many companies are taking this seriously about thinking about the environment, thinking about the social impact, thinking about their governance practices and treating employees and gender representation and among the executives? So how seriously are companies taking these measures of value?
Yeah, thanks for asking about the HIP ratings. HIP stands for Human Impact and Profit. And the short answer to your question is how many? Not enough, and not seriously enough.
Okay.
So, you know, today, traditionally, if you're a investor or investment analyst, you want to see the financial statements of the companies to show what's the revenue growth from Amazon or what are the cost reductions for your telecom provider like AT&T. But what's not on those financial statements are people, at least people as an asset. So we may have heard CEOs say people are our most important asset, and you know, whenever you hear that, the room usually laughs or giggles because we don't think they're serious. And the reason why companies are behind and lagging and there's not enough focus is because people are not an asset on the financial statements. People are an expense. And so if you listen to a Wall Street earnings call, they'll usually talk about the cost of labor and how to drive the labor costs down. You will almost never hear a company say, we've invested in our employees. You've heard a few, like Best Buy, say we've boosted minimum wage to $15 an hour. You rarely hear companies say we're creating paternity leave in addition to maternity leave for new fathers as well as new mothers. And all those investments in paying people more or in training them or in expanded benefits, those line up on accounting statements as costs, not as investments. And so there's a handful of companies who have tested putting people on the financial statements as an asset, and they have found in their people-driven businesses that that has positive returns. So that's one big gap missing from U.S. nearly every U.S. listed company and companies around the world is being able to track investments in people and to show that improvement over time. And that's why the Great Place to Work rating system and evaluation is so powerful. A second element is carbon and energy and water. And again, those are oil and water are costs of using oil and water. But there's no liabilities for the future pollution, the current and future pollution that they've created. And so there is no item on the financial statements that says, here's our carbon risk. Here's our risk of our greenhouse gas emissions. So the Carbon Disclosure Project, which has facilitated about 3,000 companies globally, we track about 7,000 at HIP, which the Presidio graduate students evaluate as part of their work in sustainable finance. And about 3,000 of them have some disclosure on estimating their carbon emissions intensity. So that starts to give a sense of what the risk might be, the future risk to investors and to your portfolio, but it's not mandated. The Securities and Exchange Commission does not mandate that. So there's a new organization in the past 5 years called the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, SASB, SASB.org. And so they've come up with what the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, could adapt as new requirements for financial disclosure and for disclosure on people and planet. So to summarize, not enough companies really focus on the drivers of value and on future risk, and the ones that do tend to outperform financially, usually with lower risk. And so if you build a portfolio of these higher sustainability companies, these higher impact companies, these higher HIP-rated companies, you increase your chances of having a stronger, more resilient portfolio that can do good and make money at the same time.
Fantastic. Well, I had a guest on here a while back. She's a professor of business school at MIT. Her name is Zeynep Tan, and she wrote a book called The Good Job Strategy. And she's trying to correct this problem that you identified. Companies actually see their employees as an expense and not an asset. And she talks about if the companies understand really that their workers are an asset and they're worth investing in and paying well, that those companies that do that actually thrive better. And she compares Costco, which has done well by its people and well with its stock, versus Walmart, which is trying to squeeze the workers, sees them as an expense to be minimized, and actually has not done so well in their stock value. So you're right on target with that. let's broaden the conversation a little beyond the individual investor to what could be done on a broader level, like with cities. And how could cities or governments more generally benefit from this kind of sustainable investing you're talking about?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for broadening it open, because the way we think about it at Presidio Graduate School, we've launched one of the first classes of its kind called multi-sector finance. And multi-sector finance is intended to convey that our problems are bigger than just business solving them or government solving them or even social sector organizations, NGOs solving them. And so we need to design financial products based on systems-wide solutions to solve affordable health care, affordable housing, fair pay. So one of the things that, you know, in your portfolio, some people have muni bonds. And muni bonds are tax-advantaged bonds where you don't have to pay tax on the interest. And historically, the IRS policy has been that that favors physical infrastructure. So if you buy a muni bond for a school or for a city or for a hospital, it is most likely, if it's tax exempt, going to expenses that will help build a physical infrastructure, a new campus, building on campus at a university like University of California, a new power plant for a government-owned utility, some water filtration equipment for water utility. All that's great. But what we don't have very easily are IRS policy that favors human capital. And so if you wanted to float a bond that would allocate more to teacher pay or to reduce the size of classrooms, or to invest in the human capital in cities, that is won't necessarily be tax exempt because the use of those dollars is not yet IRS policy or congressional law to do that. So that's one big thing we could do, is we could facilitate some policy shifts, both tax policy and tax law, that favors human capital investing. And that would allow us to do place-based investing, where a city with its school districts and hospitals, as well as its energy utilities and water utilities, could issue a combined bond that would focus on improving human capital, training students, educating them with higher-paid teachers and smaller classrooms, that then would grow up to have jobs where they wouldn't have to move away if they were in a smaller town or rural area, that where those taxes from those new jobs and talented work could then flow back into the city. So those are some really breakthrough transformational approaches in multi-sector finance that we need to facilitate through government policy. Closer to today, hundreds of cities are pursuing climate action plans. Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, those climate action plans are not funded. There's not clear financing pathways. Now, most cities, when they're doing planning, they have to finance everything they plan, except for climate action. So a group of cities, including City of Oakland and Fremont and San Luis Obispo in California, as well as Bend, Oregon, and Anchorage, Alaska, and Columbia, Missouri, are part of a project that we're helping to facilitate to map the funding and financing pathways to fund climate action in cities, whether low-income or high-income areas, whether urban or rural, and to bring that financing to creating green and net-zero energy buildings, to mobility shifts in how we commute, so to get out of one-person fossil engine cars and to get into multi-people modes or electric modes of electric scooters or bikes. And so those green bonds that cities are issuing could actually have some teeth to them. Today, if you buy a muni bond, you do not, after saying that you're going to invest in energy efficiency or water efficiency, you don't actually have to report whether you get there or not. There's no reporting of energy reduction. There's no reporting of water reduction along the way. There's no reporting of efficiency reduction. And so Washington, D.C. has issued a bond that actually does that, that actually tracks the water reductions to truly drain the swamp in D.C. from a wastewater perspective, so that wastewater doesn't flow into the Potomac River and the Chesapeake Bay. And D.C. Water has done this and will pay a reward or penalty based on how well it generates the savings from that. So lots of exciting things happening in cities, how to fund climate action plans, how to evolve muni bonds to have rewards and penalties based on actual results, and how to do place-based investing across all the elements of the places where we live, schools, hospitals, energy, and water.
That's awesome. I love what you're talking about with the what the cities are doing with this kind of creative financing to address the climate change. What about sustainable financing in nonprofits? If someone's got a nonprofit or a foundation, what could they do around this sustainable finance?
Yeah, there's some early innovations happening. So the Nature Conservancy right there in Arlington, Virginia, when John Sawhill took over the Nature Conservancy, he was my old partner at McKinsey when I worked at McKinsey, doing management consulting and energy. The Nature Conservancy offers bonds that you can buy, 5-year bonds on a variable interest and 30-year bonds on a fixed interest. And that front loads the money for them to go buy land around the country and around the world. And then they repay those bonds over time with donations over time. So other nonprofits could issue bonds based on future donations or even revenue, earned revenue, to fund things today to improve life, quality of life and quality of environment over time.
Oh, that sounds like a good plan. And so getting back to the green work here, the green bonds you're talking about with the cities, and we know today Senator Ed Markey and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York have released their bill for a Green New Deal. On this bigger scale nationally, how could sustainable finance help with the Green New Deal?
Yeah, it blends right into it. And so specifically, the Green New Deal is going to require massive capital investment. Some of it could be paid for by the government directly. Some of it will take tax incentives or tax subsidies. You know, frequently companies, states will offer incentives to companies to come place a plant there to hire for jobs. We can do that for renewable energy. We can do that for energy efficiency. We can do that for carbon reductions. And so a mix of government funding, government policy, and then using the capital markets for green bonds that could either be corporate bonds, like Apple and Starbucks and Toyota have issued green bonds to improve their infrastructure. Companies could do that for their fleets. GM and Ford could actually issue a green bond to put in place the new capital that they'll need to replicate the electric vehicle infrastructure that Tesla has just opened up its patents for. In muni bonds, most government-owned utilities, energy utilities, are very fossil-heavy with coal and coal ash ponds. And so those are going to need both some cleanup as well as a shift to renewable energy. So there's, and then even in real estate, especially by combining with the Opportunity Zones law, you could have more sustainable real estate.
And we need to end it there. That's all the time we have. Paul Herman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Delightful to be here. Thanks for having us on with Presidio.